This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
We're going to talk a little bit. We've been talking for a while about the film and about Iranian cinema, but I want to start at the beginning. You explain in the film that you kind of became infatuated with Iranian cinema in your film studies courses at university and decided to go to Iran to kind of deepen your knowledge of Iranian cinema, part of your process of writing your thesis, your PhD thesis. What made you decide to take a camera with you to Iran and make a film?
Basically, it all began with falling in love with Iranian cinema, and through cinema, falling in love with Iran. Because that perspective of Iran is so rare, you know, of growing up in India. I was 21 then, and the news, the traditional modes, the popular modes of, you know, news and media that portray Iran in a certain way is not what Iran is, or not what Iran, the Iran that I saw through cinema and Farooq's poetry, Seperi's poetry. And I just felt that, you know, this is a country that goes through so much of censorship, so much of, you know, everyday, a kind of, I mean, they go through battles every day. And that is something that's never spoken about. And the films speak about that everyday resilience. And that is something that I wanted to know. I fell in love with this whole new land that and the people that, that I discovered through cinema, through poetry. And the love came before everything else. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to go to the country, meet the people, and understand for myself, because I was 21 then. The first time I reached Iran, I was 25, very young. I'm 34 now. But then at that point of time, I think I wanted to understand how to create, how to keep expressing, how to keep singing my songs and, you know, writing my poems and telling my stories. And we had a right-wing resurgence in 2014. And at that time, I knew even more that this is the time that I need to go to Iran and understand how they do it. And hence, I figured that by the time I make this film, I'll have figured a way to keep telling, you know, what I want to say. So the idea was to reach Iran, and both the film and the PhD are means, you know, like I took these two. I decided that I should do a PhD because obviously I need to know more. A reason why the people you see in the film, you know, they take me seriously is because I was studying their histories. I made that effort. You know, crossed borders to meet them. And so that is why I needed to be grounded academically. And I always loved taking photographs when I at that time. And I had assisted a few people by then, assisted a lot of wrong people also. By then I realized that, you know, this is not the kind of work I want to do by, I mean, I feel like the only one thing that I strongly believe in is that you should assist people whose work you love. And I discovered, I mean, I realized that I need to spend time with Panahi. I need to understand how Kiarostami makes his films, and that would be the biggest lesson in my filmmaking journey. And I just realized that the camera is the best instrument that I have. And I, this is the first thing I've done. I've never made a short before. So I remember for 6 months before, you know, I was planning and before I went to Iran, I would go film every day in Calcutta. I would do a lot of breathwork exercises. I figured ways how to hold my body steady in a way that I control breathing, because when we do camera work, I think one of the most important things is to learn how to breathe. Mm-hmm. Like singing, like mm-hmm. swimming. Mm-hmm. I think breath work is so important, you know. So I really prepared myself. And then when I went to Iran, I was really at ease mm-hmm. With filming. So I picked up the camera and I picked up the pen mm-hmm. because I knew I had to go to Iran. And the ultimate goal was to walk the streets that have led to the films that I've fallen in love with. And Indians mm-hmm. are crazy about Iranian mm-hmm. cinema. So, yeah, I wanted to understand where Furu gets her inspiration from. Yeah. You know, the people, real people who've inspired her to write her verses. Mm-hmm. What leads Panahi to write the stories the mm-hmm. way he does? And where did Kiarostami's poetry come from? You know, yeah. So that was the ultimate goal.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that makes your film so compelling, is it's your discovery of filmmaking and your point of view as a first-time filmmaker mm. with your discovery of Iran. Like, these journeys are parallel. Mm. And I always think, you know, like, as a teacher, I'm a more interesting professor if I'm teaching a subject that I'm still trying to work through. As opposed to a subject that I've completely figured out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I feel like that kind of probing curiosity, that learning yeah. comes through in your filmic point of view and makes it really compelling.
Thank you.
So you've talked about wanting to consciously kind of shift the narrative frame in which Iran is often seen by outsiders. Mm-hmm. And you do this really effectively by the people that you talk to, and you can thread it throughout the film are kind of glimpses of poetry, music, the film community, and feminists, whether mm. feminist literary scholars or feminist human rights activists, you know. Can you talk a little bit about how you decided to kind of focus on those people as being the narrators of Iran for mm. you and in your film?
Mm. I think making this film, because it took 7 years to make this film, was also a journey. And above everything, all other things, the brief that I gave my editor was retain the structure of this journey. Mm-hmm. In a journey, you walk and you have, like, you think of a place that you want to reach to, but mm-hmm. the act of walking becomes important. You get lost, you meander a bit, but you come mm-hmm. back. And that's the editing structure that I've retained in the mm-hmm. film. And it really happened, you know, it just all panned out this way. When I decided to go to Iran, I was inspired by filmmakers. So my first objective, or, you know, I the first thing that I wanted to do was meet filmmakers. So mm-hmm. I knew that I have to give my life and figure a way to definitely track Panahi and mm-hmm. meet him. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to meet Kiarostami, but all journeys don't get fulfilled. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't reach your destination. Like, mm-hmm. at midpoint, you forget what your destination was. And but that's what happened with Kiarostami. I couldn't meet him, but I could do other things. But the first point was cinema, and the other thread was poetry. Mm-hmm. These are the two things that I knew I was going to follow. Mm-hmm. Furugh, I knew Furugh. I wished, because I didn't know what Iran mm-hmm. would put me to, you know, mm-hmm. like, and I think the whole, all of documentary filming is serendipity and going by your guts, I think. Because, you know, if you as a filmmaker, and it's my first film, but I'm just mm-hmm. talking about the experience of the first film, that I think I was very open. I mean, I knew I want to meet filmmakers and find Furugh, mm-hmm. but I was open to other encounters that I would be having, and mm-hmm. and that is something that I feel in my edit, and I'm very happy about it, because some of the sequences, while watching the film now, I'm like, I feel like I was so lucky to get it, you know, because even I feel that. But I think that's the beauty of documentary filmmaking, where unlike fiction, where you have a ready script, you've got total control of your script, total control of your actors, your location and set in a doc. Traditionally, if you look at how docs are done, there's something bigger controlling you.
Yeah.
And I allowed myself to flow and control.
There's an organic flow to the
film, and somewhere down the line, the act of walking became important to me. So, but I honestly hoped that as cinema opens up to life, the same thing would happen in my film. That when I would definitely meet filmmakers, but I was really hoping that the film also opens up to regular slices of everyday life. And traveling in the buses, walking in the streets, I was also filming everyday life. And Furoog and her verses sort of was the thread, and me, I was also the thread that was stitching everything together. So that happened. But everything, like the world, the outer world of Iran, came to me through chance. And the journeys, everyday little journeys every day. I would go to my Farsi class, which was in Tajrish, which is in the north of Tehran. And from the south, I'd go through Valley Asr and, you know, that stretch, and the bus ride would be 40 minutes. And that's when I would meet the most beautiful women and see such colorful characters despite the monotone clothing. And, you know, slowly they'd open up to me, and slowly as I could speak Farsi better, they would tell me their stories, and Iranians here would know how interesting the bus space is. So I was very happy to capture that. But music happened by chance, because I knew cinema and poetry would be important threads in the film, but I sing. I've been singing since four. My mother decided for me that I should sing, and I'm very thankful for to her for doing that. Music is like second skin to me. But when I went to Iran, I mean, very naturally I was going to Farsi class, but I was unconsciously picking up maximum words because I was, you know, picking up the songs. I fell in love with the songs so much. Through songs, I would learn new words, and, you know, Farsi, I was really learning Farsi through the songs. And then people would ask me to sing, and I thought it's only an Indian thing. Very, you know, like all through childhood, I remember, and a lot of Indian parents do that. They just keep saying that, oh, my child can sing. Why don't you sing now? You know, like, oh, it's a mehmooni, it's a gathering. And I've been horrified as a kid because my mother has said, you know, sing a Rabindra Sangeet right now, or, you know, sing this song right now. And I'm like, no. But then we've grown up going through that. But Panahi was doing the same thing. And then I realized that everyone was doing the same thing in Iran, because for 44 years, they hadn't really heard a woman singing, you know, the way I did. And it's rare, and it's not allowed publicly for a woman to sing. So that is when music as a theme entered the film.
Well, actually, the way you sing in the film is fairly common, right? In smaller gatherings and enclosed.
In a closed.
They hear women singing.
Enclosed doors.
So what Jaafar was asking you to do was something that is commonplace, right? But I think there's also this, you know, you can tell in his face the way he's telling the salesman, you know, she can sing, because it's there's something very sweet and touching about the fact that you're South Asian, and yet you know these classical, you know, kind of pop Persian songs, and you have a beautiful voice, and you can tell that he's proud and taking pleasure in hearing you sing. So one of the things that I really kind of noticed, you can tell that you're a scholar of Iranian film in the way you shoot the film, in a sense. And I think that's, it's interesting because you're not just taking your content from Iran, but you're also taking some of your filmic devices from Iranian filmmakers, you know? So the you know, the classic, you know, Kiarostami trope of filming in the car, you know, going down the road. And also his propensity to name his movies from Furuh Farrokhzad poetry and kind of using, you know, Furuh and Sohrab Sepehri's poetry in key, you know, scenes in this film. So if you could talk a little bit about that too, you know, kind of the way Iranian filmmaking has influenced your own point of view as a filmmaker.
I love it when people say this, but to be very honest, when I first went, I didn't do it very consciously. Mm-hmm. But when I came back with the first, you know, set of footage that I had, my first editor said this to me. You know, it really looks like, you know, the way the light falls, and you know, it really looks like you've thought through this, you know. And then I really told him I didn't. But maybe because I ate and breathed Iranian cinema, you know, the way that I did before going to Iran. I mean, it was within me. And I guess literally the light falls that way. I mean, not to take things away from me, because I did decide to shoot in a car, and the title of the film is also taken from Furugh's poem, and that I did much later. But when I also sent my rough cut, the locked cut to my colorist, he said the same thing, and then we had a variety write-up, and the journalist who sent his questions also told me that, did you tweak your light? Did you change your light? You know, what's the role of your colorist? And I gave him a cut that was uncolored. You know, so it's very interesting. I mean, yeah, I did take some decisions, like the car. You know, and I knew, and also the shooting in the car was the only feasible thing to do, because Panahi was not very comfortable in his house, because a part of his premise has cameras, and he's very not comfortable, and shooting outside would just be having things going out of control, and I was just one person. I was doing the sound myself, I was doing the camera myself, sometimes Panahi was holding the mic for me, so it just wouldn't make sense to go out in the street and, you know, have things out of control. So logically, shooting in the car also made sense, but obviously I was also thinking that, you know, this would be so good, because I went to film in 2015 right after Taxi came out, so it all made sense that way. But I'd also say that the first 3 months I wasn't, you know, thinking that, you know, I have to film this way and that way, because I didn't know how Iran would be, you know, how much I could film, how much I could shoot. Shooting outdoors was very difficult, but shooting indoors with filmmakers, it was very simple, very easy. They made me feel very comfortable. So I didn't really plan, you know, before I reached there. But the first 3 months was the best kind of Reiki that I had. When I went back again, I could make many more decisions. But it's also interesting that 60% of the film is shot in the first 3 months. I mean, 60% of what you see, or even a little bit more, 65%, is from the first 3 months.
Isn't that amazing how that happens?
Yeah.
Well, you know, sometimes our strongest influences are the ones that are subconscious, you know, like, and I think that's something that we all find in when we're creatives, right? So let's talk a little bit about, you know, you've made reference to how you went about filming in Iran. Let's talk a little bit about the logistics of it, because, you know, one of the barriers that filmmakers in Iran face, Iranian filmmakers in Iran face, is the permit system. You know, and that is usually the way censorship is enforced. You know, it's not so much like they go and they make the film and then the censor says, cut out this scene, cut out that scene. That kind of censorship happens, but the main censorship happens in the controlling of the permit system. They have to get a permit to shoot for locations. They have to get a permit for film. They have to get a permit for camera equipment. They have to get a permit for every stage of it, right? So talk about the logistics of how, but you were just your own camera person. It was just you and your camera.
Yep. So I didn't take any permits.
You went kind of rogue.
Yeah. I didn't take any permits. I mean, I'd have to take permits from the Islamic regime. I didn't want to do that. Also, I knew I'd be declined. You know, I wouldn't get any permits. So I just went for it. I just started filming. But that is the reason why it's just me. And I mean, it's so hard to make a film and do sound and camera and everything mm-hmm. yourself. Ideally, I wouldn't recommend it. Mm-hmm. The whole process of making this film literally physically also broke me. I mm-hmm. cracked my back a little bit. And all kinds of things happen when you take on literally the load of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. I don't think I can make my second film this way. But the reason why I did this was the only reason, this was the only way the film could have been done. And I mean, when I was in the street, I just walk with a camera. I always wear colorful clothes, as I was mm-hmm. telling you. And the first memory that I have of Iran after I came out from Imam Khomeini Airport was how brown everything was. Mm-hmm. All the buildings looked similar. They were all brown in that stretch. And the first time I entered into a bus, mm-hmm. In the ladies' compartment, everyone was in blues and grays and browns, and I was in green, mm-hmm. you know, because this is how mm-hmm. I've always... Mm-hmm. Indians are quite colorful that mm-hmm. way. So everyone stared at me, and I mm-hmm. felt awkward, and mm-hmm. I felt like I'm an outsider, I'm a tourist. Mm-hmm. But that's the first memory I have. But my Iranian friends tell me that we saw you as color, and... Mm-hmm. It's interesting how perceptions are different. But mm-hmm. so I did take that to my advantage. So when I was filming without permits in the streets, and you'd see it's not too many shots outside. Mm-hmm. So I would wear colorful clothes. So people really perceived me as a tourist. Mm-hmm. And because otherwise I could pass off as an Iranian, but mm-hmm. I did make an effort to look Indian. Mm-hmm. So that's how I did get the street shots. I want to talk about one thing. If you remember, in the first 3 minutes of the film, mm-hmm. there is a lady who looks at me and, mm-hmm. in a very cold, tone, says, "Are you filming me?" Mm-hmm. And the reason why I kept that shot is mm-hmm. because it changed my language of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. Because till before then, it was really like I was in a land and I was. in a bus, and mm-hmm. it felt like live cinema going mm-hmm. on before me, and I was in a trance mm-hmm. till she broke it. Mm-hmm. And for me, at that moment, I realized that this film cannot be an observational film only. Mm-hmm. I have to interact with people. It has to take a verite turn. Mm-hmm. It has to. People need to trust me to tell their stories. Mm-hmm. And that is when I remember I had a breakdown after that moment. Over there, I was like, sure, I'm sorry, I'm a tourist. Mm-hmm. And I was very cool, but I came back to my dormitory and I called my mom and I said, mm-hmm. I am terrible at this, this is what happened mm-hmm. to me. And my roommate told me, it's just been 3 days, just mm-hmm. be kind to yourself. But after that, within 1 month, mm-hmm. I learned Persian. And I mean, it was just that drive, mm-hmm. that lady, the way she told me, you mm-hmm. cannot film me like that. Mm-hmm. And it was such an important turn, it changed my perspective entirely. Mm-hmm. And after that, you see that the language changes entirely. I speak with people, I laugh with people. Mm-hmm. You hear me sing, mm-hmm. You see me. So I become a part of the narrative. Mm-hmm. It's not just that I'm observing from outside. Mm-hmm. So the outside or the exterior mm-hmm. did make me feel claustrophobic. Sometimes it mm-hmm. felt like I was being followed, but maybe nobody was following me. Mm-hmm. The panic that you see in that lady, slowly towards the end, I began feeling that panic mm-hmm. because policing in Iran doesn't happen only with policemen wearing
absolutely
plain police the uniform mm-hmm. But even that 11 or 12 year old boy in the psych policed me, and I couldn't say anything. But yeah, so it did make me feel claustrophobic, but inside was very friendly. I was filming people. By the time I was filming people, they knew what I wanted to do, not just filmmakers who preempt and know what another filmmaker wants, but even my friends, you know, the other women that you see in the film, they knew, because by that time the film was developing out of the archive of lived experience, experiences. And I think that also documentary can really tap well into, you know, documentaries. A lot of docs are born out of lived experiences.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and that's where the exchange truly begins. At least that's what happened with this film.
Yeah. One of the, so Furuk kind of becomes a muse and also is kind of threaded throughout the film. And you get, is it just completely happenstance that you discover that your friend's apartment is a home that she lived in once?
Yeah, yeah. That scene, you know, every time I, and if you look at the film another time, you'd just see me like, and you know, Farhad, a lot of people, when they reach the age of Farhad, you know, they just like, they see you and they want to tell you everything about their life. And every moment was Farhad was like that. So I needed a break sometimes from filming, because I would end up filming everything. He would be like, this is my beautiful mom. See how beautiful she is. I'm like, oh yeah, it's so beautiful. I need to film this. And he would take out Kayedu Cinema and I was like, oh, I need to film this. Then he would sing and I was like, oh, damn.
Yeah, right.
You know, and then when I thought that we are sitting to eat, and I'm eating, after a whole day of shoot, he gets up while eating. And he's like, see, this is the rent document of Farooq Farooqzad. And he didn't know I was crazy about Farooq, or he didn't know the history. And you know, Farooq Farooqzad lived here, and see, this is her rent. And I had also switched off my Zoom recorder to save some battery. And I'm like, in the shot, I'm switching it on. And I'm like, oh my God, what is happening? You know, I didn't expect that at all. But also, after 1.5 months of living in a dormitory, I discovered Farhad, and through a friend, and I sang for him, and that was it. He said, you have to come, and Tarane also, and his wife, and they were like, you have to come and stay with us.
They should teach us in film school, you know?
Who?
Filmmaker using singing to charm her way into,
you know,
interesting technique, right?
Yeah, and then, then basically I was staying with them, and I discovered much later, after 2 weeks of staying in that space, I discovered Farooq stayed here, you know, and it was surreal. And it is happenstance, you know, it's just, there's no way I could have even imagined this.
I love the way your use of location is so strategic in conveying meaning in your film. So again, going back to, you know, the opening shot of the people at Furuq's gravesite, you know, that still kind of camera shot that you take says so much about the meaning of poetry in Iranian society, and kind of feminist poetry as an enduring form of kind of social, you know. And again, you know, the upper class mall where Panahi goes to get his glasses, and your use of location, I think, is a very effective way, along with the culture workers and activists that you interview, in showing the way the quotidian forms that culture and resistance work together in Iranian society. So do you want to talk a little bit more? I mean, obviously some of your location choices were by necessity, but it does seem like that was kind of a conscious narrative tool in your filmmaking.
Yeah. I mean, also because I was figuring things out, you know, so even before I left India, I knew about Farooq's grave, that she's at Zahiruddola. And I knew that, you know, one of the first things I'm going to do is visit her grave. I just want to, and I didn't have any idea that the day I go, there'll be so many women. Someone's lighting a candle. Someone's engrossed from a speaker around the grave. A poem is playing in Farooq's voice. I had no idea, and that was within the first week of me going to Iran, and that was Iran for me. I mean, it doesn't happen every day, right? Like, you just don't go to a place and you go to your favorite poet's grave and you see there are like 10 other people who share the same feeling, and you're an Indian, like you're not even from Iran. So I, and Farooq's gone for so many years now, and I didn't expect, I always knew she's so popular, but I didn't expect women, like school, you see girls in their school uniforms, you know, just, I didn't expect to see this. So I saw how celebrated she was, and throughout the process of making this film, I truly believe that what she wrote then resonates so much now. And people quote Farooq like, I mean, so commonly, so often. So truly she connects women from all parts of the world. I mean, she potential to do that.
She cuts across class, she cuts across politics, she cuts across, you know, there's that in the poem that is at the beginning of the film, there's some lines, you know, I will plant my hands in the garden, I will grow, I know. And I think that's, you know, that sense of a woman who's self-empowered is such a big part of who she is. And of course, she was also, you know, having an affair with a famous filmmaker who was married. And when their affair was discovered, she responded to it by publishing a poem in a major Iranian newspaper. In which she was like, yeah, you know, I am having an affair. I love him. Who says you're more entitled to him because you have a marriage piece of paper? So, and this was in, you know, the 1960s in Iran, you know. So there was a fierceness and a boldness in her that I think has remained very much a resonant part of Iranian society. And then you have her, and then you have Nasreen, these two iconic feminists. So can you talk a little bit about what that was like, being with Nasreen in that window of period when she was
free,
not in prison.
But just to say one last thing, you know, that when I went to Farooq's grave that day, I didn't realize, I mean, I was still like a sponge soaking things in, but in the 3 years, what I've learned is, you know, about women in Iran is exactly the opposite of what the West portrays of how women are in Iran. Women have so much agency, so much control. They, I mean, they are active, they are fierce. A lot of the men are not. But, you know, that's, I mean, I didn't expect this because at 25, I didn't have so much guts. And that's the way I saw, you know, how women take control of everyday life in Iran. I mean, that's something I absolutely didn't expect to see. And then I also met Nasreen, and because through a friend of mine. And I'm, to be honest, I met Nasreen in the beginning before knowing her work entirely, like the details of her work. But I wanted to meet her because she was in Taxi and she could be a link to Panahi. And I knew they are best friends. And I was still trying to meet Panahi. So by the time I met Panahi, I met five people who put in a word to him and said that there's this Indian girl who's come, who's learned Persian, wants to meet you, so meet her. And in the end, he did. But I met Nasreen before that. But that day where, you know, she talks about her experiences in prison, but she talks it with, as if it's something in the past, but then she keeps doing it, and she talks about it without emotions, looking straight in your face. I mean, it took me a lot of time to edit that sequence because it's very difficult to watch. But Nasreen is exactly that person. She, without a blink in her eye, she would talk about how they didn't allow her children to visit her for 3 years. And she, without like any emotion in her face, she took out all the cards that her children sent her in prison. And the next moment she put out, you know, laid this table with all kinds of food, and I really didn't expect it, you know, like all kinds of meat and just how Iranians are, you know, they're so generous. And I didn't know someone who's so engulfed into, you know, what's happening in the country, resisting, fighting for women, fighting for, at that point of time, she was working for the rights of children. And after such a heated conversation, I would get the best food. You know what I mean? It just like, she was incredible.
I think that's also, I know we have to wrap up and go to audience questions, but I think one of the things that I think is very powerful about your film also is the way you show that the joy and struggle go hand in hand, you know? So, you know, a lot of times when you talk about Jafar Panahi, who's been in and out of prison for so much of his career, people think he's this dour person, and he's actually a really joyful person. And, you know, same with Nasreddin, you know?
There's so much mischief in the way they just talk to you. I mean, Panahi would crack jokes, and I was like, huh? Did you just say that? You know, he just could never expect it. The way he asked me to sing in the optician store, I mean, who in the world would expect
that?
And the other guy started singing with him. But I never, when to be fair, like to be honest, I expected Panahi to be a very serious person. I mean, at least I didn't expect him to be this person.
You can be a serious person and be a smartass too.
But he has so much humor. There's so much life in him. And it's even Nasri, like exactly what you said. I have to share this last story. So the first day I went to him, he pulled a trick on me. So I was like, you know, finally meeting Panahi. So I walked nine flights of stairs to meet him because the lift wasn't working. And he opens the door, and I see his iguana. It was weird. And the iguana is greeting me at the door and, you know, like, doing this. And I was like, Mr. Panahi, where are you? And the iguana is coming towards me, and he's like, do salam, you know, say salam to him. And I was like, are you serious? And then he was like, yeah, but don't you like him? It's Iggy, you have to, you know, greet him. And I was like, okay.
So the film ends with you singing to the school children. And I believe that this has become a tradition in your film festival screenings that you like to wrap up with singing. So can you take us out?
Sure.
Okay.
Would you join if I sang Sultan Ghalfa?
You believe me, these are my friends. They do not need to hear me sing.
Okay. But please join in if you know the song. Ye dil mege biram biram, ye dilam mege naram naram. Tokhet na dore delam delam bito chekonam. Pishesh ke ziba ziba kheli kuchi ke dunia dunia. Boya de toam harja harja tarkat na konam. Sultani galbam to hasti darwaze haaye dilamra shikasti peymani yari begalbam to basti boman peivasti ho akhnu nagaras to duram beharja baryad digar na bandam dilamra sarshar mazar zu tamanna aya reziba.
Thank you.
That
was beautiful.
Thank you
all so much. Please come and speak.
Thank you for coming, and I know it's such a busy time. for all of you right now, but thank you for coming and choosing to watch this film. Thank you for having this film. Thank you, Bhaskarda and Trilankur and Emily and Shiva and all of you here for making this happen.
Thank you so much. We're really grateful to you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.